From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. On today's show, the battle between Robert Kennedy and J. Edgar Hoover. We'll hear from historian Burton Hirsch, who's traced the bitter relationship between the Attorney General and his FBI director in a new book, Bobby and J. Edgar. Theirs was a struggle waged against the backdrop of the civil rights movement, a developing war in Vietnam, and battles with organized crime, with a cast of characters that included Jimmy Hoffa, Frank Sinatra, and Martin Luther King Jr. Hirsch has chronicled the Kennedy family for more than three decades. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan reads Amy Bloom's new novel, Away, and rock critic Ken Tucker defends the teeny bopper pop of sister duo Ally and AJ. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. My guest Burton Hirsch has written a new book about the complex and tortured relationship between longtime FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover and Robert Kennedy, who as Attorney General in the early 60s was technically Hoover's boss. The two men shared a visceral dislike for each other and had sharply different agendas for law enforcement in America. Hirsch writes of their struggles over the mob, labor racketeering, the civil rights movement, and the wiretapping of Martin Luther King Jr. In the end, Hirsch writes, Hoover got the upper hand in the relationship because of his knowledge of Kennedy family secrets. Burton Hirsch is a writer and historian who has chronicled the Kennedy family for over 35 years. He's the author of The Old Boys, about the origins of the CIA, and The Shadow President, a biography of Edward Kennedy. His new book is Bobby and J. Edgar, the historic face-off between the Kennedys and J. Edgar Hoover that transformed America. Well, Burton Hirsch, welcome to Fresh Air. You spent some time early in this book talking about Joe Kennedy, the father of Jack and Bobby and Ted Kennedy, and he is known to have had some connections with organized crime, as apparently did J. Edgar Hoover. What kind of relationship did Joe Kennedy and J. Edgar Hoover have with each other?
Well, the fact is they were both rising stars in the 1930s. Joe Kennedy, who had already made his first major fortunes, first in bootlegging and then in the movie business, now had aspirations to sort of redeem the family name and be an important public servant under Franklin Roosevelt, whom he helped boost into the presidency. And Hoover, who had been under something of a cloud as a result of some of his earlier civil liberties infractions, was trying to redeem himself and build the FBI, which was pretty much his creature. So the two of them were both prominent names, and Hoover and Kennedy became friends of a sort. In fact, Hoover and Clyde Tolson, his inevitable sidekick, went down to Palm Beach and spent time with Kennedy and his mansion down there, and they traded favors from then on for the rest of Joe Kennedy and, I guess, Hoover's life.
Now, in the 1950s, John Kennedy was in the Senate, a rising star with big ambitions, and his younger brother Bobby was a staff member. And when he was on the Senate committee headed by Arkansas Senator John McClellan, he was a key staff member investigating labor racketeering and organized crime, and was very, very zealous about it, as you and others have written. And when he dug deep, he would at times come upon information that reflected poorly on his father, perhaps even implicate him in criminal acts. Give us a sense. Were these a surprise to Bobby Kennedy, and how did he react?
I think for the most part they were a surprise. Joe Kennedy kept his business life away from his family. Somebody asked him, what would you do if your kids ever found out about some of the things that you're up to? He said, I'd tell them to mind their own damn business. And that sort of was the attitude, that business was one thing and not the cleanest of undertakings. And he wanted his children to grow up in another world, to be politicians, to avoid the getting their hands dirty. So there was a real dichotomy here, a real division of purposes, and that reflected in all their lives. On the other hand, I think by the middle of the 50s, at least Jack Kennedy was beginning to pick up on some of the contacts and associates that his father had. I mean, these guys were around. I mean, they showed up in the Palm Beach house. They occasionally were to be seen in Hyannisport. You couldn't miss it to some extent. On the other hand, Bobby, now this may be the direct result. Bobby, who, you know, had a sort of a choir boy side to him, was an older boy side, really, took a true dislike to these mobsters and felt that as he and the Rackets Committee dug deeper and deeper, he began to conclude that much of the country, through the unions, through Hoffa and people like that, the real power in the country was shifting over to organized crime, and that his job as sort of a crusader was to fight that, stop it, and reverse the process. And the truth is, he did. That's probably Bobby Kennedy's greatest accomplishment.
And you're right that his dad, Joe Kennedy, didn't think that this crusade to rid unions and big cities of organized crime influence was a very good idea for his sons. And I'm just curious, when Bobby did develop information which might get close to his dad, did he back off?
Well, at first, I think he tried to sort of avert his eyes. There was a big row at Christmas in the Kennedy household when Bobby announced that he was going to form the Rackets Committee. He felt, I think, that S.D. Skafoffer had done very well for himself and had actually managed to grab the vice presidential nomination in 1956 because of his association with the fight against organized crime. And Bobby saw that as an avenue for public attention for his brother and for himself. So when he indicated to his father that he was going to work with Senator McClellan and put the Rackets Committee together, the old man really exploded. He had a tremendous tantrum, and Joe Kennedy could have him. And he said, you're a damn fool. You'll destroy yourself. You'll destroy your brother's career. It's a crazy thing for you to do or even think about doing. But
if I could interrupt, Burton, was Joe Kennedy worried about what it was going to reveal about his own life, or did he just think it was politically not the right move?
Well, he said it was his explanation was that it was politically crazy because the mob and the major political bosses were all tied together. And I think he was not happy about the prospect of Bobby digging deeper and deeper and finally coming upon some indication of his own malfeasances. I think, for example, there's a section in Bobby's book on the mob, his first book on the mob, in which Bobby says that he found to his astonishment that one of the properties that mobsters were renting in New York appeared to belong to his family and so forth, to his father. Barry Goldwater saw that as Bobby dug deeper, he was getting more and more clues that the father was not innocent of mob association, and would later claim that this kind of stuff drove Bobby crazy. But I think only once Bobby became Attorney General did he get the full picture, and was he forced to, in effect, back off from his efforts to indict major top mobsters.
Some of the unsavory things that Joseph Kennedy, the father, did to amass wealth and power, it also helped them at times, including the 1960 election. What were some of the things that Joe Kennedy did, some of the unsavory things that helped his son John Kennedy win the presidency?
Well, I think you have to start out with an understanding of a presumption that both Joe Kennedy and J. Edgar Hoover made, which is that organized crime and big city politics were so entwined that you couldn't separate one from the other. If you wanted to win the big city bosses or the state bosses, especially over on the Democratic side, but to some extent, as in California on the Republican side, over to support you and get their foot soldiers out there knocking on doors and get your man into power, you pretty well had to propitiate them. And all the top mafia people had long since grown accustomed to making major donations to top political candidates. And this was true in both parties. So what Joe Kennedy was up to was not unusual, and even Franklin Roosevelt had contacts with direct and indirect with people who no Eleanor Roosevelt liberal would particularly have wanted to share office space with. For example, Sidney Hillman, who kept the unions under control for Roosevelt, at one point didn't hesitate to hire Louis Lepke, the head of Murder Incorporated, to maintain order in his union. So you had a situation where organized crime and big city bosses and big business to some extent all shared certain interests, and people like Meyer Lansky could be depended on to show up at both Democratic and Republican conventions to make sure that he thought of himself as a very successful big businessman with a few extra wrinkles. So guys like Lansky would show up and make sure their interests were looked after when the candidates were chosen.
Right.
This is the whole point, that what other people may have thought of as illegal at a certain level of deal-making was generally considered not just acceptable but mandatory.
Right, and applying a present-day standard to some of this conduct may miss some of the context. And yet, I was really shocked at some of the things you described, like a first-hand meeting that Joe Kennedy had with some of the Chicago's top mob bosses that it was explicitly about getting votes, right?
Yeah, it was. You have to understand that Joe Kennedy, right after the Second World War, had bought the Merchandise Mart, largely with borrowed money, and set up as a major landlord in Chicago. Well, if you operate in Chicago that soon after the Al Capone era, with Al Capone's heirs pulling a lot of the levers, you better have relations with these people that are serviceable both ways, and Joe Kennedy did.
If you're just joining me, my guest is writer Burton Hirsch. He has a new book, Bobby and Edgar, the historic face-off between the Kennedys and J. Edgar Hoover that transformed America. Well, when Jack Kennedy was elected to the presidency, he made his brother Bobby Attorney General, which technically made him, J. Edgar Hoover, the director of the FBI's boss. Bobby technically was Hoover's boss. And a fascinating relationship developed here. Remind us first of Hoover's style in running the FBI. He was a very idiosyncratic leader, wasn't he?
Yeah, Hoover was an unashamed autocrat. I mean, he didn't hesitate to run the FBI as a personal fiefdom. He favored people he liked. He persecuted people he didn't. He went after everybody from Albert Einstein to Charlie Chaplin and many other people whom he felt were un-American, and he didn't care much about whether they were in violation of the law or whether they weren't. He compiled the greatest set of dossiers that any government officials ever put together, and he was never shy about using them to blackmail people he didn't like. And in the case of the Kennedys, especially the father and Jack Kennedy, there was plenty to fill those dossiers with.
And little things. He wouldn't let anybody in the bureau wear red ties, is that right?
He had a million eccentricities. I mean, he was terrified of bugs. He didn't let one time when he'd been driven to his hotel, the driver had turned left and gotten into a minor automobile accident. And from then on, he wouldn't let his drivers turn left, so they would pick him up at the airport and spend half the day getting to the hotel, taking only right turns. He was a very phobic personality, and yet a very powerful and effective one.
And what about his relationship with Clyde Tolson, his lifelong companion? What was that all about?
Well, you know, who was in the room exactly? But the every indication would suggest that that Tolson and Hoover had a longstanding homosexual relationship. And even top FBI figures whom I've spoken to have been willing to go on the record and tell me that it was very plain that the two were living in many ways as if they were a married couple. They were deeply interdependent. And I think whatever the stories out there about Hoover in a dress or Hoover doing this and that, I think that relationship can be presumed to have been a sort of solid homosexual partnership.
And he was Hoover's number two guy at the FBI as well.
He was. He was a very bright guy, very obsessive, very uptight, very shrewd, capable of looking at a document, glancing over it, finding the one clause which could get the Bureau into trouble and getting that stricken out. He was the guy that Hoover used to fire the agents who weren't working out. He was the axe man. And yet he was very, in his own way, he was a moderating influence. He was the one guy that could sit down with Hoover. They had at least one meal together every day and tell him where he was going too far or where things were getting out of hand. So he was a governor, in effect, on Hoover over the many years that he ran the Bureau.
My guest is author Burton Hirsch. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Just joining me, my guest is writer Burton Hirsch. He has a new book, Bobby and Edgar, the historic face-off between the Kennedys and J. Edgar Hoover that transformed America. So when the Kennedy administration is set up, we have this brash, young, anti-mob crusader, Bobby Kennedy, now technically Hoover's boss as attorney general, and the relationship foundered on many very substantive issues like organized crime and civil rights. But there were also just some little things that Hoover really didn't like about Bobby Kennedy, right?
Well, Bobby, you know, Bobby was young, and he was a little bit casual about the way he did everything. For example, he had a giant Newfoundland dog named Brumus, and Bobby liked to bring Brumus to work, and Brumus was about as stupid and ill-disciplined an animal as ever found his way into a public building. So the first thing Brumis would do when he got there was sort of mark his territory all around Bobby Kennedy's huge reception room. Then he'd go over, and at one point, to Hoover's fury, he relieved himself right in front of Hoover's door, which angered Hoover so much that he got together his executive committee and tried to figure a pretext to take Bobby Kennedy to court and sue him for desecrating federal property. So there was a fair amount of immediate disagreement as to what of service in the federal government was all about. Hoover considered Bobby a kind of crazy hippie with phobias that would drive them all crazy. Bobby, in turn, considered Hoover a relic, you know, an antique, preoccupied with hunting down the handful of sincere communists that still existed in the country and using most of the resources of the FBI to do it. So they had a fundamental disagreement about what was happening in the country and what should be done about it. On the other hand, Bobby had no scruples about using the FBI for his own purposes, sometimes purposes that Hoover didn't agree with. And that's where the greatest rub came. Hoover treated the FBI as if it were his own personal organization. Bobby felt that the FBI should be subject to him and to do what he chose to have done, and treated him, Hoover would later complain, as if he were a desk sergeant. And that and the friction between them all but set the building afire.
And he, let me get this right, he put established a buzzer on his desk that would immediately allow him to jolt Hoover to attention?
Yeah, and Hoover never, that had never happened before. There had been, if anybody wanted Hoover, any attorney general, he would discreetly call Mrs. Gandy, Hoover's secretary, and Hoover would be informed, and then Hoover would see if he could fit the attorney general into a schedule. Now we had a situation where Bobby would press the button, Hoover would be jolted often out of an afternoon's nap and come running in red-faced and try to explain what whatever it was Bobby had in mind, and that wasn't going to work long.
In the 1950s, I mean, Bobby Kennedy was going hard after organized crime in labor racketeering, and one of his prime targets then and years after was the Teamsters leader, Jimmy Hoffa. J. Edgar Hoover, of course, was director of the FBI throughout all of this. How did he react to Kennedy's crusade against the mob, corrupt labor leaders in Hoffa?
Well, wherever possible, Hoover dragged his feet. He didn't want to see the FBI involved in any of this stuff if he could possibly help it. Furthermore, he had very, very good friends who were themselves closely associated with some of these same people. I mean, he was part of a small circle of people in Washington who were, in effect, doing PR for people like his pals, the Murchisons, at whose resort out in California Hoover and Tolson spent most of the summer. He was operating his wildcatting ventures on money that he was borrowing from the Teamsters pension fund and so forth. The team, Carlos Marcello, the mob boss in New Orleans, was dependent on Teamster money. And furthermore, all these people, many of whom, like Lansky, had lost fortunes in Havana when Castro came in, were depending on Teamster loans to build Las Vegas, which was going to be their paradise, the place where they could operate legally and found their new fortune. So once Bobby showed up and began his very energetic efforts to close all this down, they were directly threatened, and it became obvious to Carlos Marcello and others that if they wanted to get Bobby out of the picture, they had to get Jack Kennedy out of the picture, and you can write the next chapter for yourself.
Bobby Kennedy went after organized labor, as he had when he had been a U.S. Senate staffer. I mean, in particular, Jimmy Hoffa, and this at this point, I think, bore the character of a personal vendetta, didn't it?
It did, yeah. Remember that the Kennedys had cultivated the AFL-CIO and Walter Reuther, and nothing that any of the CIO operatives did, some of whom were themselves not much better than Hoffa's people, ever came under attack while Jack was campaigning for the presidency. Now Bobby was forced to try to deal with some of that as well as problems in the Teamster Union. Hoffa, who certainly was all mobbed up, nevertheless had done a great deal for the nation's truck drivers. He'd really given them a living wage. He'd provided a pension for them, he was much loved within the union. And the Teamsters was the biggest American union and by far the richest. I mean, they had upwards of $1 billion in their treasury, which Hoffa handed out to people who he felt would do him or the Teamsters some good. So he was a very powerful antagonist for Bobby.
Tell us about the physical confrontation between Jimmy Hoffa and Bobby Kennedy.
Well, you know, they really had a thing going. I mean, when Bobby was attempting to indict Hoffa, Hoffa and his lawyers showed up at the Justice Department, and they were to meet Bobby in the basement, look over some records, and Bobby was a few minutes late. He came in with a big, horrible Newfoundland Brumus, and Hoffa was furious at the fact that that Bobby had kept him waiting, and he attacked Bobby, put his fingers around Bobby's throat, and was in the process of choking him to death when all the lawyers present were able to pull Hoffa off of the Attorney General. And the question was, what was Bobby going to do about that? He decided that he would do himself more harm than good by attempting to bring a prosecution on those grounds. But Hoffa was a very tempestuous fellow. He was forever throwing his aides around the room or expressing himself in violent means. And Kennedy was not going to let a bully like that intimidate him. And on that basis, American history was made.
Historian and author Burton Hirsch, his new book is called Bobby and J. Edgar. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics Edition of the Aeneid, Virgil's Epic of the Founding of Rome, in stores and online at bn.com. And from Lionsgate, presenting Away From Her, a film by Sarah Polley, starring Gordon Pinsent, Julie Christie, and Olympia Dukakis, about love, loyalty, and self-sacrifice, on DVD September 11th. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Maureen Corrigan reviews the new novel from Amy Bloom. Ken Tucker finds he doesn't have to be a teen or a preteen to enjoy the pop of Ally and AJ. And more with Burton Hirsch. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. We're speaking with Burton Hirsch, who's written a new book about the tortured relationship between longtime FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover and Robert Kennedy, who was Attorney General in the early 60s. Now, when Bobby went after organized crime figures, and we mentioned before, when he was a Senate staffer, he would occasionally come upon information that was damaging about his father, Joe Kennedy, and his earlier associations with the mob. As Attorney General, as he got to pursuing actual prosecutions of people, you know, in a way you're playing for keeps now. And when that information came up that might have associated his father with criminals, how did Bobby react? Did he play it straight? Did he back off to protect his father?
Well, where he could, where there was a way of sort of pulling the blanket over things, he tended to allow his own charged up Justice Department to go after at least secondary criminals. But he found himself in a bad spot when Hoover decided that he would let the FBI collect evidence against Sam Giancana, who was Al Capone's heir in Chicago and had been a tremendous friend of the Kennedys and had really probably as much as anybody helped get Jack into the White House. Hoover decided to allow the FBI prosecutors to pull Giancana in and attempt to put him in the penitentiary, Giancana let it be known that if that happened, he was going to make public a lot of what had been private about the Kennedy family, about Joe in particular. And Bobby was forced to back off. He was forced to use his influence to quash the investigation. So there were limits to the extent to which Bobby's crime busting could be pursued in view of the baggage that the family was carrying.
You write that there was a moment where Bobby walked into, was it Hoover's office, and said, "You can't arrest Giancana, he knows too much"?
That's right, and he did know too much. I mean, Giancana, you must understand that Giancana was a very close friend of Frank Sinatra, and Sinatra was a very close friend of the Kennedy family. They'd traded favors for a long time. So by the time you began to unearth the details about Giancana's activities, you were now talking about major California supporters for the Kennedys. So you had a situation where the more they dug, the more they were going to find out. Sinatra was the person that introduced Judith Exner Campbell to Jack Kennedy at a time when she was also conducting a flirtation with Sam Giancana, the biggest mobster in the country. So none of this was very savory stuff, and Bobby was smart enough to know that he better not put Giancana on the stand or he might not like what he heard.
You know, one thing we have to talk a little bit about is this other huge issue that occupied the Kennedy administration and Bobby Kennedy and J. Edgar Hoover, which was the growth of the civil rights movement in the South and the growing influence of Martin Luther King. It's clear Hoover regarded King as, you know, a moral hypocrite and a dangerously subversive force in America. How did the Kennedys regard King?
Well, you know, at first their opinion wasn't that far from Hoover's. You must remember that you know, if Bobby was preoccupied with the mob, Jack Kennedy was preoccupied with nuclear annihilation. He felt that his number one job as president was to keep the superpowers from destroying each other. And we came very close at the time of the Bay of Pigs, and only very good judgment and sharp instincts on the part of both Kennedy brothers probably saved both societies at that point. So when the president was in Vienna attempting to negotiate us off the precipice, and Martin Luther King was tearing up the cities of the South, it was very counterproductive in the opinion of the Kennedy brothers. They felt that he was causing a lot of trouble. Furthermore, he was creating situations which they would then be forced to intervene in, and in the course of doing so would cause the Democratic Party in the South and the Kennedys to have ever worse prospects in 1964, which as politicians they were very aware of. So they felt that King was a troublemaker who was working a different agenda from anything that made sense to them. And only little by little, as events unfolded, did both brothers begin to understand the urgency of changing the treatment of blacks, especially in the South, in the United States.
Now, it's widely known that the FBI undertook a very aggressive surveillance of Martin Luther King, which, you know, unearthed a lot of private details. What role, if any, did Attorney General Robert Kennedy have in authorizing that surveillance?
He had a rather complicated situation that developed in the last summer of Jack Kennedy's life. And one of the people who came to the president's attention at that point was an East German woman named Ellen Romisch, a very attractive woman who had actually worked for Walter Ulbricht at one point and was in all probability maintaining some kind of connection to the Stasi, the East German Secret Service. Jack Kennedy got involved with her, and Bobby Kennedy became aware of this fact, and he also became aware of the fact that guys like John Williams, who were regarded themselves as the conscience of the country and of the Senate, were about to attempt hearings which would bring all this to light, that the president was involved with a woman who might very well be an East German spy. Well, a similar situation had brought down the government in England a few months before, and everybody became increasingly apprehensive. So Bobby was then forced to go to Hoover, who had wonderful connections in the Congress, and say, will you go to these right-wing Republican senators and call these hearings off? And Hoover, in effect, said, I'll do it, but in return, I want you to give me total license to bug and tap Martin Luther King.
Now, this is fascinating. If I can just interrupt, this is just fascinating here, because Hoover now isn't just a law enforcement guy. He has political connections. He can pull levers in the Senate. So you've got the attorney general turning to the FBI director to do political lobbying on Capitol Hill to call off an investigation, right?
Exactly. And Hoover's influence in the Congress at that point was so enormous, partly because he had these dossiers on all the senior
right.
figures in the Congress, especially the people like Rooney, who provided the money for the Bureau every year. I mean, he did favors for them. In the case of the House Committee, he had FBI accountants do the books for these guys, you know, so that he would then be sure the FBI would get as much money as they wanted. I mean, the extent of Hoover's penetration of the government, not only in the executive branch, but in the legislative branch, was unbelievable. And he, finally, Bobby was forced to crawl in and beg Hoover to give him the chance to exonerate his brother, because a story like that, which had just destroyed the Macmillan government, could very well destroy the Kennedy government.
That was in Britain, right? It was a sex scandal
Yeah, that's right. That was in Britain. And a very similar scandal, you know, the Christine Keeler scandal, if you remember that. So anyhow, Hoover prevailed. And there's some wonderful exchanges, you know, interoffice memos about this whole thing in FBI records. And he then took his pound of flesh. He not only wanted to go after Martin Luther King, he wanted the president to invite him over for lunch more. He wanted to have more reflected glory coming out of the Kennedy administration than he'd seen so far. And he got it. He got whatever he wanted. What really happened subsequently, though, interestingly enough, is that the Kennedys, both Bob and Jack, became convinced of the total unfairness of treatments of blacks in the United States and got behind a lot of civil rights legislation, which was subsequently passed by Lyndon Johnson, who was also in many ways a better civil rights man than the Kennedys. And Johnson, in turn, using legislation and techniques formed during Bobby Kennedy's Justice Department days, went after organizations like the Ku Klux Klan, which was the enforcement arm of Southern segregation, and the FBI infiltrated and virtually crushed the Klan. So many of the things that Hoover had all his life fought against, he now found himself and the Bureau forced to undertake, to expedite.
In the very last sentence of your book, you say that Hoover and Kennedy had remade America. In what ways did they change the country?
Well, despite these dark shadows that his father's career began to cast over Bob Kennedy's efforts while he was in the Justice Department, he and the crack lawyers that he assembled there put together legislation which amounted to the beginning of the end of the mob. For one thing, soon after Bob Kennedy became Attorney General, he railroaded through Congress legislation, dead-of-night type legislation, which put the FBI into the business of controlling the movement of betting information and betting devices over state lines. Now, by then, gambling was the central business of the senior mafia. So suddenly, and totally against his will, J. Edgar Hoover now found himself in the business of investigating and ultimately attempting to get indictments against major mobsters. He didn't like it, but before he realized what had happened, those laws had come onto the books through Bob Kennedy's persistent lobbying. Within people like Robert Blakey, within Kennedy's Justice Department, began to do the micro-machining that produced the RICO Act, that produced all the different techniques, the ability of mobsters willing to testify against the mob to change their identity, and the whole complex of techniques which the FBI predominantly, but other federal organizations would use to put the mob down. Up until then, it had really been pretty much up to alcohol, tobacco, and firearms, and the predecessor organization of the DEA, and particularly the Internal Revenue Service, to try to catch these guys off base and throw them in jail the way they did Al Capone, for example. Now you had instruments, legal instruments, which the FBI could use to begin to track down and deal with the senior figures of the Cosa Nostra. And well after Bob Kennedy was out of the picture, these laws were put into play, and the mob began to recede as a constant threat to American life.
Well, Burton Hirsch, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Burton Hirsch. His new book is Bobby and J. Edgar, The Historic Face-Off Between the Kennedys and J. Edgar Hoover That Transformed America. Coming up, Maureen Corrigan on the new novel by Amy Bloom. This is Fresh Air. Amy Bloom's books have been nominated for the National Book Award and the National Book Critics Circle Award. Her latest novel, Away, began attracting enthusiastic reviews even before it was published. Our book critic Maureen Corrigan weighs in.
There are a lot of surface similarities to Toni Morrison's masterpiece, Beloved, in Amy Bloom's new novel, Away. Start with that echoing one-word title. Then consider the fact that both novels are grounded in real-life stories of heroic female endurance. Morrison's main character, Setha, was modeled on the figure of fugitive slave Margaret Garner. In 1856, as slave catchers were closing in, Garner murdered her own daughter, feeling that the child was better off dead than enslaved. Bloom's Away was inspired by the story of a young Russian immigrant woman named Lillian Alling, who in 1927 walked from New York City to Alaska, where she was last reported bartering with Eskimos for passage home to Siberia. In a way, Bloom takes the novelist's liberty of filling in the mysterious gaps in Alling's tale. She imagines that, like the harrowing act committed by Margaret Garner and her fictional counterpart Setha, Lillian's epic trek was motivated by an uprush of maternal instincts. Bloom's Lillian is the only survivor of a pogrom that wiped out her family in Russia. With little more than the clothes on her back, she journeys to the Lower East Side of New York, where she finds work by day as a seamstress and by night as the mistress of a Yiddish theater owner. Then a cousin from the old country turns up with the news that Lillian's baby daughter Sophie survived the pogrom and is living with former neighbors in Siberia. That's when Lillian starts walking westward. Literary fiction is light on female on the road novels, so it's initially intriguing to see how Bloom handles this situation of a young woman shifting for herself in the wide open spaces of 1920s America. Lillian smuggles herself onto trains, rides mules through Alaska, and staggers on blistered feet to try to reach the Bering Strait. Bloom's descriptions are sometimes affecting, especially at the beginning of the novel, where she focuses on Lillian's solitude as an immigrant. Describing Lillian's daily routine, Bloom's narrator says, "She dreams of the murder of her family. She wakes to the sound of her own screaming. She eats bread and cabbage with strangers in a small, dirty room. She puts in and takes out stitches to make cheap hats, puts together blue petals and takes apart flawed silk flowers, and she does it all badly. She learns the language of a country that terrifies her so that she can dig deeper into it and make a safe hole for herself because she has no other home." Like Setha, Lillian eventually will risk everything and withstand anything prostitution, jail, even trapping and eating porcupines in the wild Yukon to be reunited with the cherished daughter she thought was dead. It was somewhere around the middle of this novel when Lillian was once again rescued by the kindness of strangers, this one a diminutive African-American prostitute named Gumdrop, that I realized that what Away really shared with Beloved were its flaws rather than its glories. Blame the contrarian critic Stanley Crouch for unforgettably enumerating those flaws. In an essay on Beloved in his 1990 collection called Notes of a Hanging Judge, Crouch ridiculed what he saw as Beloved's soap opera storyline, its mumbo-jumbo mysticism, and its simplistic worldview in which all African-American women are heroines of self-sacrifice, and all African-American men are either weak at best or at worst no good varmints like their Caucasian counterparts. I sometimes reread Crouch's essay because it's a great example of how a critic can be so smart about all that's creaky in a novel and yet miss the fact that the novel in question transcends those flaws through the animating intelligence and imaginative force of a writer's vision. Bloom's tepid Yiddish remake of Morrison's masterpiece doesn't pull off this magic trick. Her language, for one thing, would have to be much more inventive to distract us readers from a melodramatic plot and a multi-culti chorus line of cliched characters. That black hooker Gumdrop, unfortunately, isn't the novel's only tough dame with a heart of gold. As she wends her way to Siberia, Lillian is helped by Chinky Chang, a Chinese grifter, and a white card shark named Lorena, with whom Lillian shares tears. Together, we're told, the women cry over their daughters and over kindness and over the things love makes you do. It's too much schmaltz like this that ultimately makes me say oy vey about Away.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Away by Amy Bloom. Coming up, Ken Tucker on Teeny Bopper Pop he promises you'll like. This is Fresh Air. Allie and A.J. Michalka are two sisters who became famous among young teens and preteens for their appearances on TV shows on the Disney Channel. They also star in the MTV production My Super Sweet 16, the movie, which premiered in July. And they sing and write music. Rock critic Ken Tucker says their new album, Insomniatic, is a good example of why teeny bopper pop shouldn't be disdained by listeners of any age.
Allie and AJ, as this sister act is known, specialize in girl power pop featuring melodies both light and dark, with rhythms that have an elastic snap. The song that led off this review, called Closure, begins like a thousand other Broken Heart tunes with the words, "Yesterday I saw you with someone new." Then it seizes a phrase from therapy jargon to provide the musical and emotional release. "I'm getting closer to closure." The sisters' stalwart assertion is clever and fun.
Life is good, I can't complain. I mean, I could, but no one's listening. Your image overwhelms my brain, and it feels good, good, good. Now I'm rolling my window down. I love the wind, but I hate the sound. You're like a tattoo that I can't.
One thing I like about Ali and AJ is their self-consciousness. The song I just played, called Like Whoa, is a throwback to the sort of pop Michael Jackson was making with producer Quincy Jones in the 80s. Ali and AJ recall a more innocent time before they were born. Another song here is called Potential Breakup Song. Its chorus? This is the potential breakup song. Our album just needs one. The first time I heard them sing that line, I laughed out loud. And I still chuckle over the nonstop devilishness of this song, Division, another breakup tune. A ballad in which Ali and AJ, their voices entwined, inseparable, tell a loser that he, quotes, gets his degree in your separation from me.
You chose to surrender the best thing that's happened to you. What were you missing? Were you just tripping? Running away from your fear was the best you could do. You made this decision. You chose our division.
For devotees of authenticity out there who hear teen pop as manufactured material for performing puppets, I'll just shrug and point out that Ali and AJ wrote or co-wrote every song on this album. Working with the production team of Antonio Armato and Tim James, the girls take a distinctive vocal approach. Most of the time, they decline to harmonize, but sing as one, as though their voices were spliced together by more than DNA, and tell their stories in the first-person singular. The result is terrifically propulsive, headlong music like If I Could Have You Back.
On the subject of you being gone forever, I still can't believe it, I can't see it, I should just stop counting days. On the subject of the future, wouldn't it be nice to leave it open-ended and pretend it could go either way? If I could have
listen past the soaring chorus, the jittery keyboards, and the drum programming. The answer to the question posed in the title is, and I quote again, "It would be better to have a life without the constant indecision over if I could have you back." I'm not usually one to give a fig whether pop music is delivering a positive or uplifting message. But in the midst of Ali and AJ's swirling pleasure, their not-so-nascent feminism seems as logical and inevitable as their exhilarating music.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Insomniatic by Ali and AJ. You can download podcasts of Fresh Air at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today is Roberta Shorrock. Ian Chillog directed the show. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, and Jonathan Menhivar. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of the Aeneid, Virgil's epic of the founding of Rome, in stores and online at bn.com. From Courgette Records, presenting Harry Shearer's new release, Songs Pointed and Pointless, original songs, original humor, in stores, online, and at harryshearer.com. And from Lionsgate, presenting Away From Her, a film by Sarah Polley, starring Gordon Pinsent, Julie Christie, and Olympia Dukakis, about love, loyalty, and self-sacrifice, on DVD September 11th. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
We love low prices, sure, but we frown at the things companies do to get us good deals, like paying low wages. On the next Fresh Air, former Secretary of Labor under Bill Clinton, Robert Reich, looks at the divided mind of the consumer and citizen. His new book is Super Capitalism. Join us for the next Fresh Air.